Books on Tape presents Devil in the White City by Eric Larson. Read by Scott Brick. Evil's Imminent, a Note. In Chicago at the end of the 19th century, amid the smoke of industry and the clatter of trains, there lived two men, both handsome, both blue-eyed, and both unusually adept at their chosen skills. Each embodied an element of the great dynamic that characterized the rush of America toward the 20th century. One was an architect, the builder of many of America's most important structures, among them the Flatiron Building in New York and Union Station in Washington, D.C. The other was a murderer, one of the most prolific in history and harbinger of an American archetype, the urban serial killer. Although the two never met, at least not formally, their fates were linked by a single, magical event, one largely fallen from modern recollection, but that in its time was considered to possess a transformative power nearly equal to that of the Civil War. In the following pages, I tell the story of these men and this event, but I must insert here a notice. However strange or macabre some of the following incidents may seem, this is not a work of fiction. Anything between quotation marks comes from a letter, memoir, or other written document. The action takes place mostly in Chicago, but I beg readers to forgive me for the occasional lurch across state lines, as when the staunch, grief-struck Detective Geyer enters that last awful cellar. I beg forbearance, too, for the occasional side journey demanded by the story, including excursions into the medical acquisition of corpses and the correct use of Black Prince geraniums in an Olmstedian landscape. Beneath the gore and smoke and loam, this book is about the evanescence of life and why some men choose to fill their brief allotment of time engaging the impossible, others in the manufacture of sorrow. In the end, it is a story of the ineluctable conflict between good and evil, daylight and darkness, the white city and the black. Eric Larson, Seattle. Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood. Daniel H. Burnham, Director of Works, World's Columbian Exposition, 1893. I was born with the devil in me. I could not help the fact that I was a murderer, no more than the poet can help the inspiration to sing. Dr. H. H. Holmes, Confession, 1896. Prologue, Aboard the Olympic, 1912. Aboard the Olympic. The date was April 14th, 1912. A sinister day in maritime history, but of course the man in Suite 6365, Shelter Deck C, did not yet know it. What he did know was that his foot hurt badly, more than he had expected. He was 65 years old and had become a large man. His hair had turned gray, his mustache nearly white, but his eyes were as blue as ever. Bluer at this instant by proximity to the sea. His foot had forced him to delay the voyage, and now it kept him anchored in his suite while the other first-class passengers, his wife among them, did what he would have loved to do, which is explore the ship's more exotic precincts. The man loved the opulence of the ship just as he loved Pullman palace cars and giant fireplaces, but his foot problem tempered his enjoyment. He recognized that the systemic malaise that caused it was a consequence, in part, of his own refusal over the years to limit his courtship of the finest wines, foods, and cigars. The pain reminded him daily that his time on the planet was nearing an end. Just before the voyage, he told a friend, "This prolonging of a man's life doesn't interest me when he's done his work and has done it pretty well." The man was Daniel Hudson Burnham. And by now his name was familiar throughout the world. He was an architect and had done his work pretty well in Chicago, New York, Washington, San Francisco, Manila, and many other cities. He and his wife Margaret were sailing to Europe in the company of their daughter and her husband for a grand tour that was to continue through the summer. Burnham had chosen this ship, the RMS Olympic of the White Star Line, because it was new and glamorous and big. At the time he booked passage, the Olympic was the largest vessel in regular service, but just 2 days before his departure, a sister ship, a slightly longer twin, had stolen that rank when it set off on its maiden voyage. The twin, Burnham knew, was at that moment carrying one of his closest friends, the painter Francis Millet, over the same ocean, but in the opposite direction. As the last sunlight of the day entered Burnham's suite, he and Margaret set off for the first-class dining room on the deck below. They took the elevator to spare his foot the torment of the grand stairway, but he did so with reluctance, for he admired the artistry of the iron scrollwork of its balustrades and the immense dome of iron and glass that flushed the ship's core with natural light. His sore foot had placed increasing limitations on his mobility. Only a week earlier, he had found himself in the humiliating position of having to ride in a wheelchair through Union Station in Washington, D.C., the station he had designed. The Burnhams dined by themselves in the Olympic's first-class salon, then retired to their suite, and there, for no particular reason, Burnham's thoughts returned to Frank Millet. On impulse, he resolved to send Millet a mid-sea greeting via the Olympic's powerful Marconi wireless. Burnham signaled for a steward. A middle-aged man in knife-edge whites took his message up 3 decks to the Marconi room adjacent to the officer's promenade. He returned a few moments later, the message still in his hand, and told Burnham the operator had refused to accept it. Footsore and irritable, Burnham demanded that the steward return to the wireless room for an explanation. Millet was never far from Burnham's mind, nor was the event that had brought the two of them together. The great Chicago World's Fair of 1893. Millet had been one of Burnham's closest allies in the long, bittersweet struggle to build the fair. Its official name was the World's Columbian Exposition, its official purpose to commemorate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of America. But under Burnham, its chief builder, it had become something enchanting, known throughout the world as the White City. It had lasted just 6 months, yet during that time its gatekeepers recorded 27.5 million visits, this when the country's total population was 65 million. On its best day, the fair drew over 700,000 visitors. That the fair had occurred at all, however, was something of a miracle. To build it, Burnham confronted a legion of obstacles, any one of which could have, should have, killed it long before opening day. Together, he and his architects conjured a dream city whose grandeur and beauty exceeded anything each singly could have imagined. Visitors wore their best clothes and most somber expressions, as if entering a great cathedral. Some wept at its beauty. They tasted a new snack called Cracker Jack, and a new breakfast food called shredded wheat. Whole villages had been imported from Egypt, Algeria, Dahomey, and other far-flung locales, along with their inhabitants. The streets of Cairo exhibit alone employed nearly 200 Egyptians and contained 25 distinct buildings, including a 1,500-seat theater that introduced America to a new and scandalous form of entertainment. Everything about the fair was exotic and, above all, immense. The fair occupied more than 1 square mile and filled over 200 buildings. A single exhibit hall was large enough to have housed the U.S. Capitol, the Great Pyramid, Winchester Cathedral, Madison Square Garden, and St. Paul's Cathedral, all at the same time. One structure, rejected first as a monstrosity, became the fair's emblem, a machine so huge and terrifying it instantly eclipsed the Tower of Alexander Eiffel that had so wounded America's pride. Never before had so many of history's brightest lights, including Buffalo Bill, Theodore Dreiser, Susan B. Anthony, Jane Addams, Clarence Darrow, George Westinghouse, Thomas Edison, Henry Adams, Archduke Francis Ferdinand, Nikola Tesla, Ignace Paderewski, Philip Armour, Marshall Field, gathered in one place at one time. Richard Harding Davis called the exposition the greatest event in the history of the country since the Civil War. That something magical had occurred in that summer of the World's Fair was beyond doubt. But darkness, too, had touched the fair. Scores of workers had been hurt or killed in building the dream, their families consigned to poverty. There was the fire that killed 15 more, and the assassin who transformed the closing ceremony from what was to have been the century's greatest celebration into a vast funeral. Worse had occurred, although these revelations emerged only slowly. A murderer had moved among the beautiful things Burnham had created. Young women drawn to Chicago by the fair and by the prospect of living on their own had disappeared, last seen at the killer's block-long mansion, a parody of everything architects held dear. It was only after the exposition that Burnham and his colleagues learned of the anguished letters to Chicago's police describing daughters who had come to the city and then fallen silent. The press speculated that scores of fairgoers must have disappeared within the building. Even the street-hardened members of the city's Whitechapel Club, named for the London stalking grounds of Jack the Ripper, were startled by what detectives eventually found inside, and by the fact that such grisly events could have gone undiscovered for so long. The rational explanation laid blame on the forces of change that during this time had convulsed Chicago. Amid so much turmoil, it was understandable that the work of a young and handsome doctor would go unnoticed. As time passed, however, even sober men and women began to think of him in less than rational terms. He described himself as the devil and contended that his physical shape had begun to alter. Enough strange things began happening to the men who brought him to justice to make his claim seem almost plausible. For the supernaturally inclined, just the death of the jury foreman offered sufficient proof. Burnham's foot ached. The deck thrummed. No matter where you were on the ship, you felt the power of the Olympic's 29 boilers transmitted upward through the strakes of the hull. It was the one constant that told you, even in the staterooms and dining chambers and smoking lounge, despite the lavish effort to make these rooms look as if they had been plucked from the Palace of Versailles or a Jacobean mansion, that you were aboard a ship being propelled far into the bluest reaches of the ocean. Burnham and Millett were among the few builders of the fair still alive. So many others had gone. Olmsted and Codman, McKim, Hunt, Atwood, mysteriously. And that initial loss, which Burnham still found difficult to comprehend. Soon no one would remain, and the fair would cease to exist as a living memory in anyone's brain. Of the key men, who besides Millett was left? Only Lewis Sullivan, embittered, perfumed with alcohol, resenting who knew what, but not above coming by Burnham's office for a loan or to sell some painting or sketch. At least Frank Millett still seemed strong and healthy, and full of the earthy good humor that so enlivened the long nights during the fair's construction. The steward came back. The expression in his eyes had changed. He apologized. He still could not send the message, he said, but at least now he had an explanation. An accident had occurred involving Millett's ship. In fact, he said, the Olympic was at that moment speeding north at maximum velocity to come to her aid, with instructions to receive and care for injured passengers. He knew nothing more. Burnham shifted his leg and winced and waited for more news. He hoped that when the Olympic at last reached the site of the accident, he would find Millet and hear him tell some outrageous story about the voyage. In the peace of his stateroom, Burnham opened his diary. That night, the fare came back to him with extra clarity. Part 1. Frozen Music, Chicago, 1890 to 1891. The Black City. How easy it was to disappear. 1,000 trains a day entered or left Chicago. Many of these trains brought single young women who had never even seen a city, but now hoped to make one of the biggest and toughest their home. Jane Addams, the urban reformer who founded Chicago's Hull House, wrote, "Never before in civilization have such numbers of young girls been suddenly released from the protection of the home and permitted to walk unattended upon the city streets and to work under alien roofs." The women sought work as typewriters, stenographers, seamstresses, and weavers. The men who hired them were, for the most part, moral citizens intent on efficiency and profit. But not always. On March 30, 1890, an officer of the First National Bank placed a warning in the Help Wanted section of the Chicago Tribune to inform female stenographers of "our growing conviction that no thoroughly honorable businessman who is this side of dotage ever advertises for a lady stenographer who is a blonde, is good-looking, is quite alone in the city, or will transmit her photograph. All such advertisements upon their face bear the marks of vulgarity, nor do we regard it safe for any lady to answer such unseemly utterances." The women walked to work on streets that angled past bars, gambling houses, and bordellos. Vice thrived with official indulgence. The parlors and bedrooms in which honest folk lived were, as now, rather dull places, wrote Ben Hecht, late in his life, trying to explain this persistent trait of old Chicago. It was pleasant in a way to know that outside their windows, the devil was still capering in a flare of brimstone. In an analogy that would prove all too apt, Max Weber likened the city to a human being with his skin removed. Anonymous death came early and often. Each of the 1,000 trains that entered and left the city did so at grade level. You could step from a curb and be killed by the Chicago Limited. Every day, on average, 2 people were destroyed at the city's rail crossings. Their injuries were grotesque. Pedestrians retrieved severed heads. There were other hazards. Streetcars fell from drawbridges. Horses bolted and dragged carriages into crowds. Fires took 12 lives a day. In describing the fire dead, the term the newspapers most liked to use was roasted. There was diphtheria, typhus, cholera, influenza, and there was murder. In the time of the fair, the rate at which men and women killed each other rose sharply throughout the nation, but especially in Chicago, where police found themselves without the manpower and expertise to manage the volume. In the first 6 months of 1892, the city experienced nearly 800 homicides, 4 a day. Most were prosaic, arising from robbery, argument, and sexual jealousy. Men shot women, women shot men, and children shot each other by accident. But all this could be understood. Nothing like the Whitechapel killings had occurred. Jack the Ripper's 5 murder spree in 1888 had defied explanation and captivated readers throughout America who believed such things could not happen in their own hometowns. Yet things were changing. Everywhere one looked, the boundary between the moral and the wicked seemed to be degrading. Elizabeth Cady Stanton argued in favor of divorce. Victoria Woodhull advocated free love. A young woman named Borden killed her parents. And in Chicago, a young, handsome doctor stepped from a train, his surgical valise in hand. He entered a world of clamor, smoke, and steam, refulgent with the scents of murdered cattle and pigs. He found it to his liking. The letters came later, from the Sigrens, Williamses, and Smythes, and untold others, addressed to that strange, gloomy castle at 63rd and Wallace, pleading for the whereabouts of daughters and daughters' children. It was so easy to disappear, so easy to deny knowledge, so very easy in the smoke and din to mask that something dark had taken root. This was Chicago, on the eve of the greatest fair in history. The trouble is just begun. On the afternoon of Monday, February 24, 1890, 2,000 people gathered on the sidewalk and street outside the offices of the Chicago Tribune, as other crowds collected at each of the city's 28 other daily newspapers, and in hotel lobbies, in bars, and at the offices of Western Union and the Postal Telegraph Company. The gathering outside the Tribune included businessmen, clerks, traveling salesmen, stenographers, police officers, and at least one barber. Messenger boys stood ready to bolt as soon as there was news worth reporting. The air was cold. Smoke filled the caverns between buildings and reduced lateral visibility to a few blocks. Now and then police officers cleared a path for one of the city's bright yellow streetcars, called grip cars for the way their operators attached them to an ever-running cable under the street. Drays full of wholesale goods rumbled over the pavers, led by immense horses gusting steam into the murk above. The wait was electric, for Chicago was a prideful place. In every corner of the city, people looked into the faces of shopkeepers, cab drivers, waiters, and bellboys to see whether the news already had come and whether it was good or bad. So far, the year had been a fine one. Chicago's population had topped 1 million for the first time, making the city the second most populous in the nation after New York, although disgruntled residents of Philadelphia, previously in second place, were quick to point out that Chicago had cheated by annexing large expanses of land just in time for the 1890 decadal census. Chicago shrugged the sniping off. Big was big. Success today would dispel, at last, the Eastern perception that Chicago was nothing more than a greedy, hog-slaughtering backwater. Failure would bring humiliation from which the city would not soon recover, given how heartily its leading men had boasted that Chicago would prevail. It was this big talk, not the persistent southwesterly breeze, that prompted New York editor Charles Henry Dana to nickname Chicago the Windy City. In their offices in the top floor of the Rookery, Daniel Burnham, 43, and his partner John Root, newly 40, felt the electricity more keenly than most. They had participated in secret conversations, received certain assurances, and gone so far as to make reconnaissance forays to outlying parts of the city. They were Chicago's leading architects. They had pioneered the erection of tall structures and designed the first building in the country ever to be called a skyscraper. Every year, it seemed, some new building of theirs became the tallest in the world. When they moved into the Rookery at LaSalle and Adams, a gorgeous light-filled structure of Root's design, they saw views of the lake and city that no one but construction workers had seen before. They knew, however, that today's events had the potential to make their success, so far, seem meager. The news would come by telegraph from Washington. The Tribune would get it from one of its own reporters. Its editors, rewrite men, and typesetters would compose extra editions as firemen shoveled coal into the boilers of the paper's steam-driven presses. A clerk would paste each incoming bulletin to a window, face out, for pedestrians to read. Shortly after 4 o'clock, Chicago Standard Railroad time, the Tribune received its first cable. Even Burnham could not say for sure who had been first to propose the idea. It had seemed to rise in many minds at once, the initial intent simply to celebrate the 400th anniversary of Columbus's discovery of the New World by hosting a World's Fair. At first, the idea gained little momentum. Consumed by the great drive toward wealth and power that had begun after the end of the Civil War, America seemed to have scant interest in celebrating its distant past. In 1889, however, the French did something that startled everyone. In Paris, on the Champ de Mars, France opened the Exposition Universelle, a World's Fair so big and glamorous, so exotic that visitors came away believing no exposition could surpass it. At the heart of the exposition stood a tower of iron that rose 1,000 feet into the sky, higher by far than any man-made structure on Earth. The tower not only assured the eternal fame of its designer, Alexander Gustave Eiffel, but also offered graphic proof that France had edged out the United States for dominance in the realm of iron and steel, despite the Brooklyn Bridge, the Horseshoe Curve, and other undeniable accomplishments of American engineers. The United States had itself to blame for this perception. In Paris, America made only a half-hearted effort to show off its artistic, industrial, and scientific talent. We shall be ranked among those nations who have shown themselves careless of appearances, wrote the Chicago Tribune's Paris correspondent on May 13, 1889. Other nations, he wrote, had mounted exhibits of dignity and style, while American exhibitors erected a melange of pavilions and kiosks with no artistic guidance and no uniform plan. The result is a sad jumble of shops, booths, and bazaars, often unpleasing in themselves and incongruous when taken together. In contrast, France had done everything it could to ensure that its glory overwhelmed everyone. Other nations are not rivals, the correspondent wrote. They are foils to France, and the poverty of their displays sets off, as it was meant to do, the fullness of France, its richness and its splendor. Even Eiffel's Tower, forecast by wishful Americans to be a monstrosity that would disfigure forever the comely landscape of Paris, turned out to possess unexpected elan, with a sweeping base and tapered shaft that evoked the trail of a skyrocket. This humiliation could not be allowed to stand. America's pride in its growing power and international stature had fanned patriotism to a new intensity. The nation needed an opportunity to top the French, in particular to out-Eiffel Eiffel. Suddenly, the idea of hosting a great exposition to commemorate Columbus's discovery of the New World became irresistible. At first, most people in America believed that if an exposition honoring the deepest roots of the nation were to be held anywhere, the site should be Washington, the nation's capital. Initially, even Chicago's editors agreed. As the notion of an exposition gained shape, however, other cities began to see it as a prize to be coveted, mainly for the stature it would confer, stature being a powerful lure in this age when pride of place ranked second only to pride of blood. Suddenly, New York and St. Louis wanted the fair. Washington laid claim to the honor on grounds it was the center of government, New York because it was the center of everything. No one cared what St. Louis thought, although the city got a wink for pluck. Nowhere was civic pride a more powerful force than in Chicago, where men spoke of the Chicago spirit as if it were a tangible force, and prided themselves on the speed with which they had rebuilt the city after the Great Fire of 1871. They had not merely restored it. They had turned it into the nation's leader in commerce, manufacturing, and architecture. All the city's wealth, however, had failed to shake the widespread perception that Chicago was a secondary city that preferred butchered hogs to Beethoven. New York was the nation's capital of cultural and social refinement, and its leading citizens and newspapers never let Chicago forget it. The exposition, if built right, if it topped Paris, might dispel that sentiment for once and for all. The editors of Chicago's daily newspapers, upon seeing New York enter the contest, began to ask why not Chicago. The Tribune warned that the hawks, buzzards, vultures, and other unclean beasts, creeping, crawling, and flying, of New York are reaching out to get control of the fair. On June 29, 1889, Chicago's Mayor DeWitt C. Creer announced the appointment of a citizens' committee consisting of 250 of the city's most prominent men. The committee met and passed a resolution. Its closing passage read, "The men who have helped build Chicago want the fair, and having a just and well-sustained claim, they intend to have it." Congress had the final say, however, and now the time for the big vote had come. A Tribune clerk stepped to the window and pasted the first bulletin. The initial ballot put Chicago ahead by a big margin, with 115 votes to New York's 72. St. Louis came next, followed by Washington. One congressman opposed even having a fair, and out of sheer cussedness voted for Cumberland Gap. When the crowd outside the Tribune saw that Chicago led New York by 43 votes, it exploded with cheers, whistles, and applause. Everyone knew, however, that Chicago was still 38 votes shy of the simple majority needed to win the fair. Other ballots followed. Daylight faded to thin broth. The sidewalks filled with men and women leaving work. Typewriters, the women who operated the latest business machines, streamed from the Rookery, the Montauk, and other skyscrapers, wearing under their coats the customary white blouse and long black skirt that so evoked the keys of their Remingtons. Cab drivers cursed and gentled their horses. A lamplighter scuttled along the edges of the crowd, igniting the gas jets atop cast-iron poles. Abruptly, there was color everywhere. Yellow streetcars and the sudden blues of telegraph boys jolting past with satchels full of joy and gloom. Cab drivers lighting the red night lamps at the backs of their hansoms. A large gilded lion crouching before the hat store across the street. In the high buildings above, gas and electric lights bloomed in the dusk like moonflowers. The Tribune clerk again appeared in the newspaper's window, this time with the results of the fifth ballot. "The gloom that fell upon the crowd was heavy and chill," a reporter observed. "New York gained 15 votes, Chicago only 6. The gap between them had narrowed. The barber in the crowd pointed out to everyone in his vicinity that New York's additional votes must have come from congressmen who previously had favored St. Louis. This revelation caused an army lieutenant, Alexander Ross, to proclaim, "Gentlemen, I am prepared to state that any person from St. Louis would rob a church." Another man shouted, "Or poison his wife's dog." This last drew wide agreement. In Washington, the New York contingent, including Chauncey Depew, president of the New York Central and one of the most celebrated orators of the day, sensed a tide change and asked for a recess until the next day. On learning of this request, the crowd outside the Tribune booed and hissed, correctly interpreting the move as an attempt to gain time to lobby for even more votes. The motion was overruled, but the House voted for a brief adjournment. The crowd remained in place. After the seventh ballot, Chicago was only one vote short of a majority. New York had actually lost ground. A stillness settled on the street. Cabs halted. Police ignored the ever longer chains of grip cars that stretched left and right in a great cadmium gash. Passengers disembarked and watched the Tribune window, waiting for the next announcement. The cables thrumming beneath the pavement struck a minor chord of suspense and held it. Soon a different man appeared in the Tribune window. He was tall, thin, and young, and wore a black beard. He looked at the crowd without expression. In one hand he held a paste pot, in the other a brush and a bulletin sheet. He took his time. He set the bulletin on a table, out of sight, but everyone in the crowd could tell what he was doing by the motion of his shoulders. He took his time unscrewing the paste pot. There was something somber in his face, as if he were looking down upon a casket. Methodically, he painted paste onto the bulletin. It took him a good long while to raise it to the window. His expression did not change. He fastened the bulletin to the glass. Burnham waited. His office faced south, as did Roots, to satisfy their craving for natural light, a universal hunger throughout Chicago where gas jets, still the primary source of artificial illumination, did little to pierce the city's perpetual coal smoke dusk. Electric bulbs, often in fixtures that combined gas and electricity, were just beginning to light the newest buildings, but these in a sense added to the problem, for they required basement dynamos driven by coal-fired boilers. As the light faded, gas lights on the streets and in the buildings below caused the smoke to glow a dull yellow. Burnham heard only the hiss of gas from the lamps in his office. That he should be there now, a man of such exalted professional stature in an office so high above the city, would have come as a great and satisfying surprise to his dead father. Daniel Hudson Burnham was born in Henderson, New York, on September 4, 1846, into a family devoted to Swedenborgian principles of obedience, self-subordination, and public service. In 1855, when he was nine, the family moved to Chicago, where his father established a successful wholesale drug business. Burnham was a lackluster student. The records of the old Central show his average scholarship to be frequently as low as 55%, a reporter discovered, and 81% seems the highest he ever reached. He excelled, however, at drawing and sketched constantly. He was 18 when his father sent him east to study with private tutors to prepare him for the entrance exams for Harvard and Yale. The boy proved to have a severe case of test anxiety. "I went to Harvard for examination with two men not as well prepared as I," he said. "Both passed easily, and I flunked, having sat through two or three examinations without being able to write a word." The same happened at Yale. Both schools turned him down. He never forgot it. In the fall of 1867, at 21, he returned to Chicago. He sought work in a field where he might be successful and took a job as a draftsman with the architectural firm of Loring and Jenny. He had found his calling, he wrote in 1868, and told his parents he wanted to become the greatest architect in the city or country. The next year, however, he bolted for Nevada with friends to try his hand at mining gold. He failed. He ran for the Nevada legislature and failed again. He returned to Chicago broke in a cattle car and joined the firm of an architect named L.G. Lorien. Then came October 1871. A cow, a lantern, confusion, and wind. The Great Chicago Fire took nearly 18,000 buildings and left over 100,000 people homeless. The destruction promised endless work for the city's architects. But Burnham quit. He was 25 years old. He sold plate glass, failed. He became a druggist, quit. There is, he wrote, a family tendency to get tired of doing the same thing very long. Exasperated and worried, Burnham's father in 1872 introduced his son to an architect named Peter White, who admired the young man's skill at drawing and hired him as a draftsman. Burnham was 25. He liked White and liked the work. He liked especially one of White's other draftsmen, a southerner named John Wellborn Root, who was 4 years younger. Born in Lumpkin, Georgia on January 10, 1850, Root was a musical prodigy who could sing before he could talk. During the Civil War, as Atlanta smoldered, Root's father smuggled him to Liverpool, England, aboard a Confederate blockade runner. Root won acceptance into Oxford, but before he could matriculate, the war ended, and his father summoned him back to America, to his new home in New York City, where Root studied civil engineering at New York University and became a draftsman for the architect who later designed St. Patrick's Cathedral. Burnham took to Root immediately. He admired Root's white skin and muscular arms, his stance at the drafting table. They became friends, then partners. They recorded their first income 3 months before the panic of 1873 snuffed the nation's economy. This time Burnham stuck with it. Something about the partnership with Root bolstered him. It filled an absence and played to both men's strengths. They struggled for their own commissions and in the meantime hired themselves out to other more established firms. One day in 1874, a man walked into their office and in a single galvanic moment changed their lives. He wore black, looked ordinary, but in his past there was blood, death, and profit in staggering quantity. He came looking for Root, but Root was out of town. He introduced himself instead to Burnham and gave his name as John B. Sherman. There was no need to amplify the introduction. As superintendent of the Union Stockyards, Sherman ruled an empire of blood that employed 25,000 men, women, and children, and each year slaughtered 14 million animals. Directly and indirectly, nearly one-fifth of Chicago's population depended on the yards for its economic survival. Sherman liked Burnham. He liked his strength, his steady blue gaze, and the confidence with which he conducted the conversation. Sherman commissioned the firm to build him a mansion on Prairie Avenue at 21st Street, among homes owned by other Chicago barons, and where now and then Marshall Field, George Pullman, and Philip Armour could be seen walking to work together, a titanic threesome in black. Root drew a house of 3 stories with gables and a peaked roof, in red brick, buff sandstone, blue granite, and black slate. Burnham refined the drawings and guided construction. Burnham happened to be standing in the entrance to the house, considering the work, when a young man with a mildly haughty air and an odd strut, not ego here, but a congenital fault, walked up to him and introduced himself, giving his name as Lewis Sullivan. The name meant nothing to Burnham. Not yet. Sullivan and Burnham talked. Sullivan was 18, Burnham 28. He told Sullivan in confidence that he did not expect to remain satisfied doing just houses. "My idea," he said, "is to work up a big business, to handle big things, deal with big businessmen, and to build up a big organization, for you can't handle big things unless you have an organization." John Sherman's daughter Margaret also visited the construction site. She was young, pretty, and blonde, and visited often, using as her excuse the fact that her friend Della Otis lived across the street. Margaret did think the house very fine, But what she admired most was the architect, who seemed so at ease among the cairns of sandstone and timber. It took a while, but Burnham got the point. He asked her to marry him. She said yes. The courtship went smoothly. Then, scandal broke. Burnham's older brother forged checks and wounded their father's wholesale drug business. Daniel immediately went to Margaret's father to break the engagement on grounds the courtship could not continue in the shadow of scandal. Sherman told him he respected Burnham's sense of honor, but rejected his withdrawal. He said quietly, "There is a black sheep in every family." Later, Sherman, a married man, would run off to Europe with the daughter of a friend. Burnham and Margaret married on January 20, 1876. Sherman bought them a house at 43rd Street and Michigan Avenue, near the lake, but more importantly, near the stockyards. He wanted proximity. He liked Burnham and approved of the marriage, but he did not entirely trust the young architect. He thought Burnham drank too much. Sherman's doubts about Burnham's character did not color his respect for his skill as an architect. He commissioned other structures. In his greatest vote of confidence, he asked Burnham en route to build an entry portal for the Union Stockyards that would reflect the yard's growing importance. The result was the stone gate, three arches of Lamont limestone roofed in copper and displaying over the central arch the carved busts, Roots touch, no doubt, of John Sherman's favorite bull, Sherman. The gate became a landmark that endured into the 21st century, long after the last hog crossed to eternity over the great wooden ramp called the Bridge of Sighs. Root also married a daughter of the stockyards. His experience was darker. He designed a house for John Walker, president of the yards, and met Walker's daughter Mary. During their courtship, she became ill with tuberculosis. The disease rapidly gained ground, but Root remained committed to the engagement, even though it was clear to everyone he was marrying a dead woman. The ceremony was held in the house Root designed. A friend, the poet Harriet Monroe, waited with the other guests for the bride to appear on the stairway. Monroe's sister Dora was the sole bridesmaid. "A long wait frightened us," Harriet Monroe said, "but at last the bride, on her father's arm, appeared like a white ghost at the halfway landing, and slowly, oh, so hesitatingly, dragging her heavy satin train, stepped down the wide stairway and across the floor to the bay window, which was gay with flowers and vines. The effect was weirdly sad. Root's bride was thin and pale and could only whisper her vows. Her gaiety, Harriet Monroe wrote, seemed like jewels on a skull." Within 6 weeks, Mary Walker Root was dead. 2 years later, Root married the bridesmaid, Dora Monroe, and very likely broke her poet sister's heart. That Harriet Monroe also loved Root seems beyond dispute. She lived nearby and often visited the couple in their Astor Place home. In 1896, she published a biography of Root that would have made an angel blush. Later, in her memoir, A Poet's Life, she described Root's marriage to her sister as being so completely happy that my own dreams of happiness, confirmed by that example, demanded as fortunate a fulfillment and could accept nothing less. But Harriet never found its equal and devoted her life instead to poetry, eventually founding Poetry Magazine, where she helped launch Ezra Pound toward national prominence. Root and Burnham prospered. A cascade of work flowed to their firm, partly because Root managed to solve a puzzle that had bedeviled Chicago builders ever since the city's founding. By solving it, he helped the city become the birthplace of skyscrapers, despite terrain that could not have been less suited to the role. In the 1880s, Chicago experienced explosive growth that propelled land values to levels no one could have imagined, especially within the downtown loop, named for the turnaround loops of streetcar lines. As land values rose, landowners sought ways of improving the return on their investments. The sky beckoned. The most fundamental obstacle to height was man's capacity to walk stairs, especially after the kinds of meals men ate in the 19th century. But this obstacle had been removed by the advent of the elevator and, equally important, by Elisha Graves Otis's invention of a safety mechanism for halting an elevator in freefall. Other barriers remained, however, the most elemental of which was the bedeviling character of Chicago's soil, which prompted one engineer to describe the challenge of laying foundations in Chicago as probably not equaled for perverseness anywhere in the world. Bedrock lay 125 feet below grade, too deep for workers to reach with any degree of economy or safety using the construction methods available in the 1880s. Between this and the surface was a mixture of sand and clay, so saturated with water that engineers called it gumbo. It compressed under the weight of even modest structures and drove architects, as a matter of routine, to design their buildings with sidewalks that intersected the first story 4 inches above grade, in the hope that when the building settled and dragged the sidewalks down with it, the walks would be level. There were only 2 known ways to resolve the soil problem. Build short and avoid the issue, or drive caissons down to bedrock. The latter technique required that workers excavate deep shafts, shore the walls, and pump each so full of air that the resulting high pressure held water at bay, a process notorious for causing deadly cases of the bends and used mainly by bridge builders who had no other choice. John Augustus Roebling used caissons famously in building the Brooklyn Bridge, but their first use in the United States occurred earlier, from 1869 through 1874, when James B. Eads built a bridge over the Mississippi at St. Louis. Eads discovered that workers began experiencing the bends at 60 feet below ground, roughly half the depth to which a Chicago caisson would have to descend. Of the 352 men who worked on the bridge's notorious East caisson, pressure-related illness killed 12, left 2 crippled for life, and injured 66 others, a casualty rate of over 20%. But Chicago's landowners wanted profits, and at the city's center, profit meant height. In 1881, a Massachusetts inventor, Peter Chardon Brooks III, commissioned Burnham and Root to build the tallest office building yet constructed in Chicago, which he planned to call the Montauk. Previously, he had brought them their first big downtown commission, the 7-story Granice Block. In that structure, Burnham said, our originality began to show. It was a wonder. Everybody went to see it, and the town was proud of it. They moved their offices into its top floor. A potentially fatal move, as it happens, but no one knew it at the time. Brooks wanted the new building to be 50% taller, if, Brooks said, the earth can support it. The partners quickly grew frustrated with Brooks. He was picky and frugal and seemed not to care how the building looked as long as it was functional. He issued instructions that anticipated by many years Lewis Sullivan's famous admonition that form must follow function. The building throughout is to be for use and not for ornament, Brooks wrote. Its beauty will be in its all adaptation to its use. Nothing was to project from its face, no gargoyles, no pedimenta, for projections collected dirt. He wanted all pipes left in the open. This covering up of pipes is all a mistake. They should be exposed everywhere, if necessary, painted well and handsomely. His frugal glare extended to the building's bathrooms. Root's design called for cabinets under sinks. Brooks objected. A cabinet made a good receptacle for dirt, mice, too. The trickiest part of the Montauk was its foundation. Initially, Root planned to employ a technique that Chicago architects had used since 1873 to support buildings of ordinary stature. Workers would erect pyramids of stone on the basement slab. The broad bottom of each pyramid spread the load and reduced settlement. The narrow top supported load-bearing columns. To hold up 10 stories of stone and brick, however, the pyramids would have to be immense, the basement transformed into a Giza of stone. Brooks objected. He wanted the basement free for the boilers and dynamo. The solution when Root first struck it must have seemed too simple to be real. He envisioned digging down to the first reasonably firm layer of clay, known as hardpan, and there spreading a pad of concrete nearly 2 feet thick. On top of this, workers would set down a layer of steel rails stretching from one end of the pad to the other, and over this, a second layer at right angles. Succeeding layers would be arranged the same way. Once complete, this grillage of steel would be filled and covered with Portland cement to produce a broad, rigid raft which Root called a floating foundation. What he was proposing, in effect, was a stratum of artificial bedrock that also would serve as the floor of the basement. Brooks liked it. Once built, the Montauk was so novel, so tall, it defied description by conventional means. No one knows who coined the term, but it fit, and the Montauk became the first building to be called a skyscraper. What Chartres was to the Gothic Cathedral, wrote Thomas Talmadge, a Chicago architect and critic, the Montauk block was to the high commercial building. This was the heyday of architectural invention. Elevators got faster and safer. Glassmakers became adept at turning out ever larger sheets of plate glass. William Jenney of the firm Loring and Jenney, where Burnham started his architectural career, designed the first building to have a load-bearing metal frame in which the burden of supporting the structure was shifted from the exterior walls to a skeleton of iron and steel. Burnham and Root realized that Jenney's innovation freed builders from the last physical constraints on altitude. They employed it to build taller and taller buildings, cities in the sky inhabited by a new race of businessmen, whom some called cliff dwellers. These were men, wrote Lincoln Steffens, who will not have an office unless it is up where the air is cool and fresh, the outlook broad and beautiful, and where there is silence in the heart of business. Burnham and Root became rich men. Not Pullman rich, not rich enough to be counted among the first rank of society alongside Potter Palmer or Philip Armour, or to have their wives' gowns described in the city's newspapers, but rich beyond anything either man had expected. Enough so that each year Burnham bought a barrel of fine Madeira and aged it by shipping it twice around the world on slow freighters. As their firm prospered, the character of each partner began to emerge and clarify. Burnham was a talented artist and architect in his own right, but his greatest strength lay in his ability to win clients and execute the elegant designs of Root. Burnham was handsome, tall, and strong, with vivid blue eyes, all of which drew clients and friends to him the way a lens gathers light. "Daniel Hudson Burnham was one of the handsomest men I ever saw," said Paul Sterrett, later to lead construction of the Empire State Building. He joined Burnham and Root in 1888 as an all-purpose helper. It was easy to see how he got commissions. His very bearing and looks were half the battle. He had only to assert the most commonplace thing, and it sounded important and convincing. Sterrett recalled being moved by Burnham's frequent admonition, "Make no little plans. They have no magic to stir men's blood." Burnham understood that Root was the firm's artistic engine. He believed Root possessed a genius for envisioning a structure quickly in its entirety. "I've never seen anyone like him in this respect," Burnham said. He would grow abstracted and silent, and a faraway look would come into his eyes, and the building was there before him, every stone. At the same time, he knew Root had little interest in the business side of architecture and in sowing the relationships at the Chicago Club and Union League that eventually led to commissions. Root played the organ every Sunday morning at the First Presbyterian Church. He wrote opera critiques for the Chicago Tribune. He read broadly in philosophy, science, art, and religion, and was known throughout Chicago's upper echelon for his ability to converse on almost any subject, and to do so with great wit. His conversational powers were extraordinary, a friend said. There seemed to be no subject which he had not investigated and in which he was not profoundly learned. He had a sly sense of humor. One Sunday morning he played the organ with particular gravity. It was a while before anyone noticed he was playing Shoe Fly. When Burnham and Root were together, one woman said, "I used always to think of some big, strong tree with lightning playing around it." Each man recognized and respected the other's skills. The resultant harmony was reflected in the operation of their office, which, according to one historian, functioned with the mechanical precision of a slaughterhouse. An apt allusion given Burnham's close professional and personal association with the stockyards. But Burnham also created an office culture that anticipated that of businesses that would not appear for another century. He installed a gym. During lunch hour, employees played handball. Burnham gave fencing lessons. Root played impromptu recitals on a rented piano. The office was full of a rush of work, Sterrett said, but the spirit of the place was delightfully free and easy and human in comparison with other offices I had worked in. Burnham knew that together he and Root had reached a level of success neither could have achieved on his own. The synchrony with which they worked allowed them to take on ever more challenging and daring projects, at a time when so much that an architect did was new, and when dramatic increases in the height and weight of buildings amplified the risk of catastrophic failure. Harriet Monroe wrote, "The work of each man became constantly more necessary to the other." As the firm grew, so did the city. It got bigger, taller, richer, but it also grew dirtier, darker, and more dangerous. A miasma of cinder-flecked smoke blackened its streets and at times reduced visibility to the distance of a single block, especially in winter with coal furnaces in full roar. The ceaseless passage of trains, grip cars, trolleys, and carriages, Surreys, Landaus, Victorias, Broughams, Phaetons, and hearses, all with ironclad wheels that struck the pavement like rolling hammers, produced a constant thunder that did not recede until after midnight, and made the open window nights of summer unbearable. In poor neighborhoods, garbage mounded in alleys and overflowed giant trash boxes that became banquet halls for rats and bluebottle flies. Billions of flies. The corpses of dogs, cats, and horses often remained where they fell. In January, they froze into disheartening poses. In August, they ballooned and ruptured. Many ended up in the Chicago River, the city's main commercial artery. During heavy rains, the water of the river flowed in a greasy plume far out into Lake Michigan, to the towers that marked the intake pipes for the city's drinking water. In rain, any street not paved with macadam oozed a fragrant muck of horse manure, mud, and garbage that swelled between granite blocks like pus from a wound. Chicago awed visitors and terrified them. French editor Octave Uzan called it that Gordian city, so excessive, so satanic. Paul Lindau, an author and publisher, described it as a gigantic peep show of utter horror, but extraordinarily to the point. Burnham loved Chicago for the opportunity it afforded, but he grew wary of the city itself. By 1886, he and Margaret were the parents of five children, two daughters and three sons, the last a boy named Daniel, born in February. That year, Burnham bought an old farmhouse on the lake in the quiet village of Evanston, called by some the Athens of suburbs. The house had 16 rooms on two floors, was surrounded by superb old trees, and occupied a long rectangle of land that stretched to the lake. He bought it despite initial opposition from his wife and her father, and did not tell his own mother of his planned move until the purchase was complete. Later, he wrote her an apology. "I did it," he explained, "because I can no longer bear to have my children in the streets of Chicago." Success came easily to Burnham and Root, but the partners did have their trials. In 1885, a fire destroyed the Granis Block, their flagship structure. At least one of them was in the office at the time and made his escape down a burning stairway. They moved next to the top floor of the rookery. 3 years later, a hotel they had designed in Kansas City collapsed during construction, injuring several men and killing one. Burnham was heartbroken. The city convened a coroner's inquest, which focused its attention on the building's design. For the first time in his career, Burnham found himself facing public attack. Burnham wrote to his wife, "You must not worry over the affair, no matter what the papers say. There will no doubt be censure and much trouble before we get through, all of which we will shoulder in a simple, straightforward, manly way. So much as in us lies." The experience cut him deeply, in particular the fact his competence lay exposed to the review of a bureaucrat over whom he had no influence. "The coroner," he wrote Margaret 3 days after the collapse, "is a disagreeable little doctor, a political hack without brains who distresses me." Burnham was sad and lonesome and wanted to go home. "I do so long to be there and be at peace again with you." A third blow came in this period, but of a different character. Although Chicago was rapidly achieving recognition as an industrial and mercantile dynamo, its leading men felt keenly the slander from New York that their city had few cultural assets. To help address this lack, one prominent Chicagoan, Ferdinand W. Peck, proposed to build an auditorium so big, so acoustically perfect, as to silence all the carping from the East and make a profit to boot. Peck envisioned enclosing this gigantic theater within a still larger shell that would contain a hotel, banquet room, and offices. The many architects who dined at Kinsley's restaurant, which had a stature in Chicago equal to that of Delmonico's in New York, agreed this would be the single most important architectural assignment in the city's history, and that most likely it would go to Burnham and Root. Burnham believed likewise. Peck chose Chicago architect Dankmar Adler. If acoustically flawed, Peck knew, the building would be a failure no matter how imposing the finished structure proved to be. Only Adler had previously demonstrated a clear grasp of the principles of acoustical design. "Burnham was not pleased," wrote Lewis Sullivan, by now Adler's partner, "nor was John Root precisely entranced." When Root saw early drawings of the auditorium, he said it appeared as if Sullivan was about to smear another facade with ornament. From the start, there was tension between the two firms, although no one could have known it would erupt years later in a caustic attack by Sullivan on Burnham's greatest achievements. This after Sullivan's own career had dissolved in a mist of alcohol and regret. For now, the tension was subtle, a vibration, like the inaudible cry of overstressed steel. It arose from discordant beliefs about the nature and purpose of architecture. Sullivan saw himself as an artist first, an idealist. In his autobiography, in which he always referred to himself in the third person, He described himself as an innocent with his heart wrapped up in the arts, in the philosophies, in the religions, in the beatitudes of nature's loveliness, in his search for the reality of man, in his profound faith in the beneficence of power. He called Burnham a colossal merchandiser, fixated on building the biggest, tallest, costliest structures. He was elephantine, tactless, and blurting. Workers began building the auditorium on June 1, 1887. The result was an opulent structure that, for the moment, was the biggest private building in America. Its theater contained over 4,000 seats, 1,200 more than New York's Metropolitan Opera House. And it was air-conditioned through a system that blew air over ice. The surrounding building had commercial offices, an immense banquet hall, and a hotel with 400 luxurious rooms. A traveler from Germany recalled that by simply turning an electric dial on the wall by his bed, he could request towels, stationery, ice water, newspaper, whiskey, or a shoe shine. It became the most celebrated building in Chicago. The President of the United States, Benjamin Harrison, attended its grand opening. Ultimately, these setbacks proved to be minor ones for Burnham and Root. Far worse was to occur, and soon. But as of February 14, 1890, the day of the great fair vote, the partners seemed destined for a lifetime of success. Outside the Tribune building, there was silence. The crowd needed a few moments to process the news. A man in a long beard was one of the first to react. He had sworn not to cut the beard until Chicago got the fair. Now he climbed the steps of the adjacent Union Trust Company bank. On the top step, he let out a shriek that one witness likened to the scream of a skyrocket. Others in the crowd echoed his cry, and soon 2,000 men and women and a few children, mostly telegraph boys and hired messengers, cut loose with a cheer that tore through the canyon of brick, stone, and glass like a flash flood. The messenger boys raced off with the news, while throughout the city, telegraph boys sprinted from the offices of the Postal Telegraph Company and Western Union, or leapt aboard their Pope safety bikes, one bound for the Grand Pacific Hotel, another the Palmer House, others to the Richelieu, Auditorium, Wellington, the gorgeous homes on Michigan and Prairie, the clubs, Chicago, Century, Union League, and the expensive brothels, in particular, Carrie Watson's place with its lovely young women and cascades of champagne. One telegraph boy made his way through the dark to an unlit alley that smelled of rotted fruit and was silent save for the receding hiss of gas lights on the street he had left behind. He found a door and knocked and entered a room full of men, some young, some old, all seeming to speak at once, a few quite drunk. A coffin at the center of the room served as a bar. The light was dim and came from gas jets hidden behind skulls mounted on the walls. Other skulls lay scattered about the room. A hangman's noose dangled from the wall, as did assorted weapons and a blanket caked with blood. These artifacts marked the room as headquarters of the Whitechapel Club, named for the London slum in which 2 years earlier Jack the Ripper had done his killing. The club's president held the official title The Ripper. Its members were mainly journalists, who brought to the club's meetings stories of murder harvested from the city's streets. The weapons on the wall had been used in actual homicides and were provided by Chicago policemen, the skulls by an alienist at a nearby lunatic asylum, the blanket by a member who acquired it while covering a battle between the army and the Sioux. Upon learning that Chicago had won the fair, the men of the Whitechapel Club composed a telegram to Chauncey Depew, who more than any other man symbolized New York and its campaign to win the fair. Previously, Depew had promised the members of the Whitechapel Club that if Chicago prevailed, he would present himself at the club's next meeting to be hacked apart by the Ripper himself. Metaphorically, he presumed, although with the Whitechapel Club, could one ever be certain? The club's coffin, for example, had once been used to transport the body of a member who had committed suicide. After claiming his body, the club hauled it to the Indiana Dunes on Lake Michigan, where members erected an immense pyre. They placed the body at the top, then set it alight. They carried torches and wore black hooded robes and circled the fire, singing hymns to the dead between sips of whiskey. The club also had a custom of dispatching members in their black robes to kidnap visiting celebrities and steal them away in a black coach with covered windows, all this without saying a word. The club's telegram reached Depew in Washington 20 minutes after the final ballot, just as Chicago's delegation began celebrating at the Willard Hotel near the White House. The telegram asked, "When may we see you at our dissecting table?" Depew sent an immediate response. "I am at your service when ordered and quite ready after today's events to contribute my body to Chicago science." Although gracious in acknowledging defeat, Depew in fact doubted Chicago really understood the challenge that lay ahead. The most marvelous exhibit of modern times, or ancient times, has now just closed successfully at Paris, he told the Tribune. Whatever you do is to be compared with that. If you equal it, you have made a success. If you surpass it, you have made a triumph. If you fall below it, you will be held responsible by the whole American people for having assumed what you are not equal to. Beware, he warned. Take care. Chicago promptly established a formal corporation, the World's Columbian Exposition Company, to finance and build the fair. Quietly, officials made it clear that Burnham and Root would be the lead designers. The burden of restoring the nation's pride and prominence in the wake of the Paris Exposition had fallen upon Chicago, and Chicago, in turn, had lodged it firmly, if for now discreetly, on the top floor of the rookery. Failure was unthinkable. If the fair failed, Burnham knew, the nation's honor would be tarnished, Chicago humiliated, and his own firm dealt a crushing blow. Everywhere Burnham turned, there was someone, a friend, an editor, a fellow club member, telling him that the nation expected something tremendous out of this fair, and expected it in record time. The auditorium alone had taken nearly 3 years to build and driven Lewis Sullivan to the brink of physical collapse. Now Burnham and Root were being called upon to build what amounted to an entire city in about the same amount of time. Not just any city, but one that would surpass the brilliance of the Paris Exposition. The fair also would have to make a profit. Among Chicago's leading men, profitability was a matter of personal and civic honor. By traditional architectural standards, the challenge seemed an impossible one. Alone, neither architect could do it, but together, Burnham believed, he and Root had the will and the interlocking powers of organization and design to succeed. Together they had defeated gravity and conquered the soft gumbo of Chicago soil to change forever the character of urban life. Now, together, they would build the fair and change history. It could be done, because it had to be done. But the challenge was monstrous. Depew's oratory on the fair quickly grew tiresome, but the man had a way of capturing with wit and brevity the true character of a situation. "Chicago is like the man who marries a woman with a ready-made family of 12," he said. "The trouble is just begun." Even Depew, however, did not foresee the true magnitude of the forces converging on Burnham and Root. At this moment, he and they saw the challenge only in its two most fundamental dimensions, time, and money, and these were stark enough. Only Poe could have dreamed the rest. The necessary supply. One morning in August 1886, as heat rose from the streets with the intensity of a child's fever, a man calling himself H.H. Holmes walked into one of Chicago's train stations. The air was stale and still, suffused with the scent of rotted peaches, horse excrement, and partially combusted Illinois anthracite. Half a dozen locomotives stood in the train yard, exhaling steam into the already yellow sky. Holmes acquired a ticket to a village called Englewood in the town of Lake, a municipality of 200,000 people that abutted what was then Chicago's southernmost boundary. The township encompassed the Union Stockyards and two large parks, Washington Park, with lawns, gardens, and a popular racetrack, and Jackson Park, a desolate, undeveloped waste on the lakeshore. Despite the heat, Holmes looked fresh and crisp. As he moved through the station, the glances of young women fell around him like wind-blown petals. He walked with confidence and dressed well, conjuring an impression of wealth and achievement. He was 26 years old. His height was 5 feet 8 3/4 inches. He weighed only 155 pounds. He had dark hair and striking blue eyes, once likened to the eyes of a mesmerist. "The eyes are very big and wide open," a physician named John L. Capon later observed. "They are blue. Great murderers, like great men in other walks of activity, have blue eyes." Capon also noted thin lips, tinted by a full, dark mustache. What he found most striking were Holmes's ears. "It is a marvelously small ear, and at the top it is shaped and carved after the fashion in which old sculptors indicated deviltry and vice in their statues of satyrs." Overall, Capon noted, he is made on a very delicate mold. To women as yet unaware of his private obsessions, it was an appealing delicacy. He broke prevailing rules of casual intimacy. He stood too close, stared too hard, touched too much and long. And women adored him for it. He stepped from the train into the heart of Englewood and took a moment to survey his surroundings. He stood at the intersection of 63rd and Wallace. A telegraph pole at the corner held fire alarm box number 2475. In the distance rose the frames of several three-story homes under construction. He heard the concussion of hammers. Newly planted trees stood in soldierly ranks, but in the heat and haze they looked like desert troops gone too long without water. The air was still, moist and suffused with the burned licorice scent of freshly rolled macadam. On the corner stood a shop with a sign identifying it as E.S. Holton Drugs. He walked. He came to Wentworth Street, which ran north and south and clearly served as Englewood's main commercial street, its pavement clotted with horses, drays, and phaetons. Near the corner of 63rd and Wentworth, he passed a fire station that housed Engine Company No. 51. Next door was a police station. Years later, a villager with a blind spot for the macabre would write, "While at times there was considerable need of a police force in the Stockyards district, Englewood pursued the even tenor of its way with very little necessity for their appearance, other than to ornament the landscape and see that the cows were not disturbed in their peaceful pastures." Holmes returned to Wallace Street, where he had seen the sign for Holton Drugs. Tracks crossed the intersection. A guard sat squinting against the sun watching for trains, and every few minutes lowered a crossing gate as yet another locomotive huffed past. The drugstore was on the northwest corner of Wallace and 63rd. Across Wallace was a large vacant lot. Holmes entered the store and there found an elderly woman named Mrs. Holton. He sensed vulnerability, sensed it the way another man might capture the trace of a woman's perfume. He identified himself as a doctor and licensed pharmacist and asked the woman if she needed assistance in her store. He spoke softly and smiled often and held her in his frank blue gaze. He was good with conversation, and soon she revealed to him her deepest sorrow. Her husband, upstairs in their apartment, was dying of cancer. She confessed that managing the store while caring for him had become a great burden. Holmes listened with moist eyes. He touched her arm. He could ease her burden, he said. Not only that, he could turn the drugstore into a thriving establishment and conquer the competition up the block. His gaze was so clear and blue. She told him she would have to talk to her husband. She walked upstairs. The day was hot. Flies rested on the windowsill. Outside, yet another train rumbled through the intersection. Cinder and smoke like soiled gauze drifted past the window. She would talk to her husband, yes, but he was dying, and she was the one who now managed the store and bore its responsibilities, and she had come to a decision. There was a warm attentiveness about the young doctor that could lighten her days in the hard time ahead when she would lose her husband. That she would lose him was beyond doubt. Daily he seemed to shrink within his bedclothes. His sleep had grown fitful. He would wake with the passing of each train. On these hot nights, closing the windows was unthinkable, and she lay there in the moist, iron-filled dark, fearing a future alone. Just thinking about the young doctor, seeing those kind blue eyes, gave her a feeling of contentment she had not experienced in a long while. Holmes had been to Chicago before, but only for brief visits. The city impressed him, he said later, which was surprising because, as a rule, nothing impressed him. Nothing moved him. Events and people captured his attention the way moving objects caught the notice of an amphibian. First, a machine-like registration of proximity, next, a calculation of worth, last, a decision to act or remain motionless. When he resolved at last to move to Chicago, he was still using his given name, Herman Webster Mudgett. As for most people, his initial sensory contact with Chicago had been the fantastic stink that lingered always in the vicinity of the Union Stockyards, a Chinook of putrefaction and incinerated hair, an elemental odor, wrote Upton Sinclair, raw and crude. It was rich, almost rancid, sensual, and strong. Most people found it repulsive. The few who found it invigorating tended to be men who had waded in its river of death, Sinclair's phrase, and panned from it great fortunes. It is tempting to imagine that all that death and blood made Mudgett feel welcome, but more realistic to suppose it merely conveyed a sense that here at last was a city that allowed a broader range of behavior than was tolerated in Gilmanton Academy, New Hampshire, the town in which he was born and where he drifted through childhood as a small, odd, and exceptionally bright boy, and where, as a consequence, in the cruel imaginations of his peers, he became prey. The memory of one episode stayed with him throughout his life. He was 5, wearing his first boy's suit, when his parents sent him off to begin his education at the village schoolhouse. I had daily to pass the office of one village doctor, the door of which was seldom, if ever, barred, he wrote in a later memoir. Partly from its being associated in my mind as the source of all the nauseous mixtures that had been my childish terror, for this was before the day of children's medicines, and partly because of vague rumors I had heard regarding its contents, this place was one of peculiar abhorrence to me. In those days, a doctor's office could indeed be a fearsome place. All doctors were, in a sense, amateurs. The best of them bought cadavers for cash, no questions asked, and preserved particularly interesting bits of diseased viscera in large clear bottles. Skeletons hung in offices for easy anatomical reference. Some transcended function to become works of art, so detailed, so precisely articulated. Every bleached bone hitched to its neighbor with brass under a skull grinning with slap-shoulder bonhomie, that they appeared ready to race chattering down the street to catch the next grip car. Two older children discovered Mudgett's fear and one day captured him and dragged him, struggling and shrieking, into the doctor's office. Nor did they desist, Mudgett wrote, until I had been brought face to face with one of its grinning skeletons, which, with arms outstretched, seemed ready in its turn to seize me. It was a wicked and dangerous thing to do to a child of tender years and health, he wrote, but it proved an heroic method of treatment, destined ultimately to cure me of my fears and to inculcate in me, first, a strong feeling of curiosity, and later a desire to learn, which resulted years afterwards in my adopting medicine as a profession. The incident probably did occur, but with a different choreography. More likely, the two older boys discovered their 5-year-old victim did not mind the excursion, that far from struggling and shrieking, he merely gazed at the skeleton with cool appreciation. When his eyes settled back upon his captors, it was they who fled. Gilmanton was a small farming village in New Hampshire's Lake Country, sufficiently remote that its residents did not have access to a daily newspaper and rarely heard the shriek of train whistles. Mudgett had 2 siblings, a brother and sister. His father Levi was a farmer, as was Levi's own father. Mudgett's parents were devout Methodists whose response to even routine misbehavior relied heavily on the rod and prayer, followed by banishment to the attic and a day with neither speech nor food. His mother often insisted he pray with her in her room, then filled the air around him with trembly passion. By his own assessment, he was a mother's boy. He spent a good deal of time alone in his room reading Jules Verne and Edgar Allan Poe and inventing things. He built a wind-powered mechanism that generated noise to scare birds from the family fields and set out to create a perpetual motion machine. He hid his most favored treasures in small boxes, among them his first extracted tooth and a photograph of his 12-year-old sweetheart. Although later observers speculated these boxes also contained treasures of a more macabre sort, such as the skulls of small animals that he disabled and then dissected alive in the woods around Gilmanton. They based this speculation on the hard lessons learned during the 20th century about the behavior of children of similar character. Mudgett's only close friend was an older child named Tom, killed in a fall while the boys were playing in an abandoned house. Mudgett gouged his initials into an old elm tree at his grandfather's farm, where the family marked his growth with notches in a door jamb. The first was less than 3 feet high. One of his favorite pastimes was to hike to a high boulder and shout to generate an echo. He ran errands for an itinerant photographer who stopped for a time in Gilmanton. The man had a pronounced limp and was glad for the help. One morning, the photographer gave Mudgett a broken block of wood and asked him to take it to the town wagon maker for a replacement. When Mudgett returned with the new block, he found the photographer sitting beside his door, partly clothed. Without preamble, the photographer removed one of his legs. Mudgett was stunned. He had never seen an artificial limb before and watched keenly as the photographer inserted the new block into a portion of the leg. Had he next proceeded to remove his head in the same mysterious way, I should not have been further surprised, Mudgett wrote. Something about Mudgett's expression caught the photographer's eye. Still on one leg, he moved to his camera and prepared to take Mudgett's picture. Just before he opened the shutter, he held up his artificial leg and waved it at the boy. Several days later, he gave Mudgett the finished photograph. I kept it for many years, Mudgett wrote, and the thin, terror-stricken face of that barefooted, homespun-clad boy I can yet see. At the time Mudgett described this encounter in his memoir, he was sitting in a prison cell hoping to engineer a swell of public sympathy. While it is charming to imagine the scene, the fact is the cameras that existed during Mudgett's boyhood made candid moments almost impossible to capture, especially when the subject was a child. If the photographer saw anything in Mudgett's eyes, it was a pale blue emptiness that he knew, to his sorrow, no existing film could ever record. At 16, Mudgett graduated school and, despite his age, took a job as a teacher, first in Gilmanton and then in Alton, New Hampshire, where he met a young woman named Clara A. Lovering. She had never encountered anyone quite like Mudgett. He was young but poised and had a knack for making her feel good even when she was inclined to feel otherwise. He spoke so well and with such warmth, always touching her in small, affectionate ways, even in public. His great flaw was his persistent demand that she allow him to make love to her, not as a lover in formal courtship, but in that way that was supposed to come only after marriage. She held him off but could not deny that Mudgett aroused within her an intensity of desire that colored her dreams. Mudgett was 18 when he asked her to elope. She agreed. They married July 4, 1878, before a justice of the peace. At first there was passion far beyond what the dour gossip of older women had led Clara to expect, but their relationship chilled rapidly. Mudgett left the house for long periods. Soon he was gone for days at a time. Finally, he was just gone. In the wedding registry of Alton, New Hampshire, they remained married, their contract a legal, if desiccated, thing. At 19, Mudgett went to college. Initially, he set his sights on Dartmouth, but changed his mind and went instead directly into medical school. He enrolled first in the medicine program at the University of Vermont in Burlington, but found the school too small and after only 1 year moved to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, one of the West's leading scientific medical schools, noted for its emphasis on the controversial art of dissection. He enrolled on September 21, 1882. During the summer of his junior year, he committed what he called, in his memoir, "The first really dishonest act of my life." He took a job as a traveler for a book publisher assigned to sell a single book throughout northwestern Illinois. Instead of turning in the proceeds, he kept them. At the end of the summer, he returned to Michigan. "I could hardly count my western trip a failure," he wrote, "for I had seen Chicago." He graduated in June 1884 with a lackluster record and set out to find some favorable location in which to launch a practice. To do so, he took another job as a traveler, this time with a nursery company based in Portland, Maine. His route took him through towns he might otherwise never have encountered. Eventually, he came to Moore's Forks, New York, where, according to the Chicago Tribune, the trustees of the Moore's Forks grade school, impressed with Mudgett's gentlemanly manners, hired him as the school principal, a post he held until he at last opened a medical practice. Here I stayed for 1 year doing good and conscientious work, for which I received plenty of gratitude, but little or no money. Wherever he went, troubling things seemed to occur. His professors in Michigan had little to say about his academic talents, but recalled that he had distinguished himself in a different way. Some of the professors here recollected him as being a scamp, the university said. He had a breach of promise with a hairdresser, a widow, who came to Ann Arbor from St. Louis, Michigan. In Moore's Forks, there were rumors that a boy seen in his company had disappeared. Mudgett claimed the boy had returned to his own home in Massachusetts. No investigation took place. No one could imagine the charming Dr. Mudgett causing harm to anyone, let alone a child. At midnight, many nights, Mudgett would pace the street outside his lodging. Mudgett needed money. Teaching had paid a poverty wage. His medical practice yielded an income only slightly larger. In the fall of 1885, he wrote, starvation was staring me in the face. While in medical school, he and a fellow student, a Canadian, had talked about how easy it would be for one of them to buy life insurance, make the other the beneficiary, then use a cadaver to fake the death of the one insured. In Moore's, the idea came back to Mudgett. He paid a visit to his former classmate and found that his financial condition was no better. Together, they devised an elaborate life insurance fraud, which Mudgett described in his memoir. It was an impossibly complex and gruesome plan, likely beyond the powers of anyone to execute, but his description is noteworthy for what it revealed, without his intention, about his astigmatic soul. Broadly stated, the plan called for Holmes and his friend to recruit a couple of other accomplices, who together would fake the deaths of a family of three and substitute cadavers for each person. The bodies would turn up later in an advanced state of decomposition, and the conspirators would divide the $40,000 death benefit, equivalent to over $1 million in 21st century valuation. The scheme called for a considerable amount of material, Mudgett wrote, no less than three bodies, in fact, meaning he and his friend somehow had to acquire three cadavers roughly resembling the husband, wife, and child. The key word here was material. Mudgett foresaw no difficulty in acquiring the cadavers, although in fact a national shortage of corpses for medical education had by then driven doctors to raid graveyards for the freshly dead. Recognizing that even a doctor could not secure three bodies at once without raising suspicion, Mudgett and his accomplice agreed that each should contribute toward the necessary supply. Mudgett claimed to have gone to Chicago in November 1885 and there to have acquired his portion of the bodies. Unable to find a job, he placed his portion in storage and left for Minneapolis, where he found work in a drugstore. He remained in Minneapolis until May 1886, when he left for New York City, planning to take a part of the material there and to leave the rest in Chicago. This, he said, necessitated repacking the same. He claimed to have deposited one package of dismembered cadaver in the Fidelity storage warehouse in Chicago. The other accompanied him to New York, where he lodged it in a safe place. During his train journey to New York, however, he read two newspaper articles about insurance crime, and for the first time I realized how well organized and well prepared the leading insurance companies were to detect and punish this kind of fraud. These articles, he claimed, caused him to abandon the plan and to jettison all hope of ever succeeding at such a scheme in the future. He was lying. In fact, Mudgett was convinced that the fundamentals of the approach had merit, that by faking the deaths of others, he could indeed fleece life insurance companies. As a physician, he knew no means existed for establishing the identities of burned, dismembered, or otherwise disfigured corpses, and he did not mind handling bodies. They were material, no different than firewood, although somewhat more difficult to dispose of. He was lying, too, about needing money. The owner of the house in Moore's Forks where he boarded, D.S. Hayes, noticed Mudgett often displayed large sums of cash. Hayes grew suspicious and watched Mudgett closely, albeit not closely enough. Mudgett left Moore's Fork at midnight without paying his lodging bill to Hayes. He made his way to Philadelphia, where he hoped to situate himself in a drugstore and eventually to become a partner or owner. He found nothing suitable, however, and instead took a job as a keeper at the Norristown Asylum. "This," he wrote, "was my first experience with insane persons, and so terrible was it that for years afterwards, even now sometimes, I see their faces in my sleep." Within days, he quit. Eventually, he did find a position at one of Philadelphia's drugstores. Soon afterward, a child died after taking medicine acquired at the store. Mudgett immediately left the city. He caught a train for Chicago, but quickly found that he could not work as a druggist in Illinois until he passed a licensing examination in the state capital in Springfield. There, in July 1886, the year Sir Arthur Conan Doyle introduced his detective to the world, Mudgett registered his name as Holmes. Holmes understood that powerful new forces were acting upon Chicago, causing a nearly miraculous expansion. The city was growing in all available directions, and where it abutted the lake, it grew skyward, sharply increasing the value of land within the loop. Everywhere he looked, he saw evidence of the city's prosperity. Even the smoke was proof. The city's newspapers loved to crow about the startling increase in the number of workers employed by Chicago's industries, especially meatpacking. Holmes knew, everyone knew, that as skyscrapers soared and the stockyards expanded their butchery, the demand for workers would remain high, and where those workers and their supervisors would seek to live was the city's suburbs, with their promise of smooth macadam, clean water, decent schools, and above all, fresh air, untainted by the stench of rotting offal from the Union Yards. As the city's population swelled, demand for apartments turned into flat fever. When people could not find or afford apartments, they sought rooms in private homes and boarding houses, where typically the rent included meals. Speculators thrived and created eerie landscapes. In Calumet, 1,000 ornate street lamps stood in a swamp where they did nothing but ignite the fog and summon auras of mosquitoes. Theodore Dreiser reached Chicago about when Holmes did and was struck by this landscape of anticipation. The city had laid miles and miles of streets and sewers through regions where perhaps one solitary house stood out alone, he wrote in Sister Carrie. There were regions open to the sweeping winds and rain, which were yet lighted throughout the night with long, blinking lines of gas lamps fluttering in the wind. One of the fastest-growing suburbs was Englewood. Even a newcomer like Holmes could tell that Englewood was booming. Real estate advertisements were full of testimonials to its location and appreciating values. Englewood, in fact, had been growing quickly ever since the Great Fire of 1871. One resident recalled how immediately after the fire, there was such a rush for homes in Englewood, and the population increased so rapidly that it was impossible to keep up with it. Old railroad men still called it Chicago Junction or Junction Grove or simply the Junction for the 8 railroad lines that converged within its borders. But after the Civil War, residents grew weary of the industrial resonance of the name. In 1868, a Mrs. H.B. Lewis suggested a new one, Englewood, the name of a New Jersey town in which she previously had lived and which had taken its name from a forest in Carlisle, England, legendary for having sheltered two outlaws of Robin Hood stripe. It was here, in what Chicagoans called a streetcar suburb, that stockyard supervisors chose to settle, as did officials of companies headquartered in the skyscrapers of the Loop. They acquired big houses on streets named Harvard and Yale that were lined with elm, ash, sycamore, and linden, and posted with signs barring all but essential wagon traffic. They sent their children to the Cook County Normal School and went to church and attended meetings of the Masons and of 45 other secret societies having lodges, kingdoms, and hives in the village. On Sundays, they wandered among the velvet lawns of Washington Park and, if in the mood for solitude, the wind-blasted ridges of Jackson Park at the easternmost end of 63rd Street on the lakeshore. They took trains and streetcars to work and congratulated themselves on living upwind of the stockyards. The developer of a large Englewood parcel touted this asset in a catalog promoting the auction of 200 residential lots called the Bates's Subdivision. To the businessmen of the Union Stockyards, it is particularly convenient and accessible, and free from the odors that are wafted by the prevailing winds to the most fashionable localities of the city. Dr. Holton did die. Holmes made his widow an offer. He would buy the store, and she could continue to reside in the second-floor apartment. He couched his offer in prose that made it seem as if he were proposing the purchase not to benefit himself, but solely to free the grieving Mrs. Holton from the burden of work. He touched her arm as he spoke. After she signed the deed over to him, he stood and thanked her, with tears in his eyes. He financed the purchase mainly with money he raised by mortgaging the store's fixtures and stock, agreeing to repay the loan at a rate of $100 a month, about $3,000 in 21st century value. My trade was good, he said, and for the first time in my life, I was established in a business that was satisfactory to me. He put up a new sign, H.H. Holmes Pharmacy. As word spread that a young, handsome, and apparently unmarried young doctor now stood behind the counter, an increasing number of single women in their 20s began to patronize the store. They dressed nicely and bought things they did not need. Long-time customers also liked the new proprietor, but they missed the comforting presence of Mrs. Holton. The Holtons had been there when their children were sick, had comforted them when these illnesses proved mortal. They knew Mrs. Holton had sold the place, but why had they not seen her around town? Holmes smiled and explained that she had decided to visit relatives in California, something she had long wanted to do but could never find the time or money to accomplish, and certainly could not have done with her husband on his deathbed. As time wore on and the inquiries dwindled, Holmes modified the story a bit. Mrs. Holton, he explained, liked California so much, she had decided to settle there permanently. In the light blazing through the drugstore window, Holmes's eyes seemed bluer than ever. Becomingness. Nothing. There had been so much energy, so much bravado, but now, nothing. It was July 1890, nearly 6 months since Congress had voted to give the World's Columbian Exposition to Chicago, but the 45 men on the exposition's board of directors still had not decided where within the city the fair should be built. At the time of the vote, with the city's pride at stake, all Chicago had sung with one voice. Its emissaries had boasted to Congress that the city could deliver a grander and more appropriate setting than anything New York, Washington, or any other city could propose. Now, however, Each quarter of Chicago was insisting on a location within its own boundaries, and the squabbling had stymied the board. The Fair's Committee on Grounds and Buildings had asked Burnham, quietly, to evaluate a number of locations in the city. With equal discretion, the committee assured Burnham and Root that ultimately they would direct the design and construction of the fair. For Burnham, each lost moment was a theft from the already scanty fund of time allotted to build the exposition. The final fair bill signed in April by President Benjamin Harrison established a dedication day for October 12, 1892, to honor the moment 400 years earlier that Columbus first sighted the New World. The formal opening, however, would not occur until May 1, 1893, to give Chicago more time to prepare. Even so, Burnham knew, much of the fair would have to be done by the dedication. That left just 26 months. A friend of Burnham's, James Ellsworth, was one of the board's directors. He, too, was frustrated by the stalemate, so much so that on his own initiative, during a business trip to Maine in mid-July, he visited the Brookline, Massachusetts office of Frederick Law Olmsted to try and persuade him to come to Chicago and evaluate the sites under consideration, and perhaps take on the task of designing the fair's landscape. Ellsworth hoped that Olmsted's opinion, backed by his reputation as the Wizard of Central Park, would help force a decision. That Ellsworth, of all people, should be driven to this was significant. Initially, he had been ambivalent about whether Chicago should even seek the World's Fair. He agreed to serve as a director only out of fear that the exposition was indeed at risk of fulfilling the meager expectations of the East and becoming simply a fair, as the term generally implies. He believed it imperative that the city protect its civic honor by producing the greatest such event in the world's history, a goal that seemed to be slipping from Chicago's grasp with each sweep of the clock. He offered Olmsted a consulting fee of $1,000, equivalent to about $30,000 today. That the money was his own and that he lacked official authority to hire Olmsted were two points Ellsworth failed to disclose. Olmsted declined. He did not design fairs, he told Ellsworth. He doubted, moreover, that enough time remained for anyone to do the fair justice. To produce the kind of landscape effects Olmsted strived to create required not months, but years, even decades. I have all my life been considering distant effects and always sacrificing immediate success and applause to that of the future, he wrote. In laying out Central Park, we determined to think of no result to be realized in less than 40 years. Ellsworth insisted that what Chicago had in mind was something far grander than even the Paris Exposition. He described for Olmsted a vision of a dream city designed by America's greatest architects and covering an expanse at least one-third larger than the Paris Fair. Ellsworth assured Olmsted that by agreeing to help, he would be joining his name to one of the greatest artistic adventures of the century. Relenting slightly, Olmsted said he would think about it and agreed to meet with Ellsworth 2 days later on Ellsworth's return from Maine. Olmsted did think about it and began to see the exposition as an opportunity to achieve something for which he had fought long and hard, but almost always with disappointing result. Throughout his career, he had struggled with little success to dispel the perception that landscape architecture was simply an ambitious sort of gardening, and to have his field recognized instead as a distinct branch of the fine arts, full sister to painting, sculpture, and brick-and-mortar architecture. Olmsted valued plants, trees, and flowers not for their individual attributes, but rather as colors and shapes on a palette. Formal beds offended him. Roses were not roses, but flecks of white or red modifying masses of green. It irked him that few people seemed to understand the effects he worked so long and hard to create. I design with a view to a passage of quietly composed, soft, subdued, pensive character, shape the ground, screen out discordant elements, and get suitable vegetation growing. Too often, however, he would come back in a year and find destruction. Why? My wife is so fond of roses. I had a present of some large Norway spruces. I have a weakness for white birch trees. There was one in my father's yard when I was a boy. The same things happened with large civic clients. He and Calvert Vaughs built and refined Central Park from 1858 through 1876, but forever afterward Olmsted found himself defending the park against attempts to tinker with its grounds in ways he considered tantamount to vandalism. It wasn't just Central Park, however. Every park seemed subject to such abuse. Suppose, he wrote to architect Henry Van Brunt, that you had been commissioned to build a really grand opera house, that after the construction work had been nearly completed and your scheme of decoration fully designed, you should be instructed that the building was to be used on Sundays as a Baptist tabernacle, and that suitable place must be made for a huge organ, a pulpit, and a dipping pool. Then at intervals afterwards you should be advised that it must be so refitted and furnished that parts of it could be used for a courtroom, a jail, a concert hall, hotel, skating rink, for surgical clinics, for a circus, dog show, drill room, ballroom, railway station, and shot tower. That, he wrote, is what is nearly always going on with public parks. Pardon me if I overwhelm you. It is a matter of chronic anger with me. What landscape architecture needed, Olmsted believed, was greater visibility, which in turn would bring greater credibility. The exposition could help, he realized, provided it did rise to the heights envisioned by Ellsworth. He had to weigh this benefit, however, against the near-term costs of signing on. His firm already had a full roster of work. So much, he wrote, that we are always personally under an agitating pressure and cloud of anxiety. And Olmsted himself had grown increasingly susceptible to illness. He was 68 years old and partly lame from a decades-old carriage accident that had left one leg an inch shorter than the other. He was prone to lengthy bouts of depression. His teeth hurt. He had chronic insomnia and facial neuralgia. A mysterious roaring in his ears at times made it difficult for him to attend to conversation. He was still full of creative steam, still constantly on the move, but overnight train journeys invariably laid him low. Even in his own bed, his nights often became sleepless horrors laced with toothache. But Ellsworth's vision was compelling. Olmsted talked it over with his sons and with the newest member of the firm, Henry Sargent Codman, Harry, an intensely talented young landscape architect who quickly had become a trusted advisor and confidant. When Ellsworth returned, Olmsted told him he had changed his mind. He would join the venture. Once back in Chicago, Ellsworth secured formal authority to hire Olmsted and arranged to have him report directly to Burnham. In a letter to Olmsted, Ellsworth wrote, "My position is this. The reputation of America is at stake in this matter, and the reputation of Chicago is also at stake. As an American citizen, you have an equal interest in furthering the success of this great and grand undertaking, and I know from talking with you that on an occasion like this, you grasp the whole situation and will be confined to no narrow limits." Certainly that seemed to be the case when, during later contract negotiations, Olmsted, at Codman's urging, requested a fee of $22,500, about $675,000 today, and got it. On Wednesday, August 6, 1890, 3 weeks after Ellsworth's Brookline visit, the exposition company telegraphed Olmsted, "When can you be here?" Olmsted and Codman arrived 3 days later on Saturday morning and found the city ringing from the news that the final census count had confirmed the earlier, preliminary ranking of Chicago as America's second-largest city. Even though this final tally also showed that Chicago's lead over Philadelphia was a skimpy one, only 52,324 souls. The good news was a salve for a difficult summer. Earlier, a heat wave had brutalized the city, killing 17 people, including a man named Christ, and neatly eviscerating Chicago's boasts to Congress that the city possessed the charming summer climate, cool and delicious, the Tribune had said, of a vacation resort. And just before the heat wave, a rising young British writer had published a scalding essay on Chicago. "Having seen it," Rudyard Kipling wrote, "I desire never to see it again. It is inhabited by savages." To Burnham, Codman seemed amazingly young, late 20s at the most. To be so young and have the trust of America's greatest landscape architect, Codman must have been very bright indeed. He had gleaming obsidian eyes that looked as if they could punch holes in steel. As for Olmsted, Burnham was struck by the slightness of his frame, which seemed structurally insufficient to support so massive a skull. That head. Bald for most of its surface, trimmed at bottom with a tangled white beard, it resembled an ivory Christmas ball resting on a bed of excelsior. Olmsted looked worn from his travels, but his eyes were large, warm, and bright. He wanted to start work immediately. Here, at last, Burnham saw, was a man who understood the true cost of each lost minute. Burnham, of course, knew of Olmsted's achievements. Central Park in Manhattan, Prospect Park in Brooklyn, the grounds of Cornell and Yale, and scores of other projects. He knew also that before launching the field of landscape architecture, Olmsted had been a writer and editor who had journeyed throughout the antebellum South exploring the culture and practice of slavery. Olmsted had a reputation for brilliance and tireless devotion to his work, but also for an acerbic candor that emerged most predictably in the presence of men who failed to understand that what he sought to create were not flower beds and ornamental gardens, but expanses of scenery full of mystery, shadow, and sun-stippled ground. Olmsted, for his part, knew that Burnham had been a leading force in driving buildings into the clouds. Burnham was said to be the business genius of his firm, Root the Artist. It was with Burnham that Olmsted felt the greatest kinship. Burnham was decisive, blunt, cordial, and spoke under a level blue gaze that Olmsted found reassuring. In private communication, Olmsted and Codman agreed that Burnham was a man they could work with. The tour began at once, but it was hardly an objective one. Burnham and Root clearly favored one location in particular, Jackson Park on Chicago's south side, due east of Englewood on the lakeshore. As it happens, Olmsted knew this ground. 20 years earlier, at the request of Chicago's South Park commissioners, Olmsted had studied both Jackson Park and, to its west, Washington Park, and the broad boulevard that connected them, called Midway. In the plans he had produced for the commissioners, he envisioned transforming Jackson Park from a desert of sand and stagnant pools into a park unlike any other in the nation, focused on water and boating, with canals, lagoons, and shady coves. Olmsted finished those plans shortly before the Great Fire of 1871. In the rush to rebuild, Chicago never got around to realizing his vision. The park became part of Chicago during the 1889 annexations, but otherwise, Olmsted saw, little had changed. He knew its flaws, its many flaws, but believed that with a lot of deft dredging and sculpting, the park could be transformed into a landscape unlike any that ever seated an exposition. For he recognized that Jackson Park had something no other city in the world could equal: the spreading blue plain of Lake Michigan, as comely a backdrop for a fair as anyone could hope for. On Tuesday, August 12th, just 4 days after he and Codman arrived in Chicago, he filed a report with the exposition directors, who then, to Olmsted's chagrin, made the report public. Olmsted had intended the report for a professional audience, one that would take for granted Jackson Park's fundamental acceptability and value the report as an unflinching guide to the challenges ahead. He was surprised to find the report put to use by opposing cliques as evidence that the fair could not possibly be placed in Jackson Park. The directors asked for a second report. Olmsted delivered it on Monday, August 18th, 6 days after the first. Burnham saw to his delight that Olmsted had given the directors somewhat more than they perhaps had wished to receive. Olmsted was no literary stylist. Sentences wandered through the report like morning glory through the pickets of a fence. But his prose revealed the depth and subtlety of his thinking about how landscape could be modified to produce an effect in the mind. First, he had to set down a few principles and do a little chiding. Rather than squabbling over sites, he lectured, the different factions needed to recognize that for the exposition to succeed, everyone had to work together, no matter what location the directors selected. It is to be desired, let us say, that it should be better understood than it yet seems to be by some of your fellow citizens, that the fair is not to be a Chicago fair. It is a world's fair, and Chicago is to stand before the world as the chosen standard-bearer for the occasion of the United States of America. All Chicago can afford to take nothing less than the very best site that can be found for the fair, regardless of the special local interests of one quarter of the city or another. Every landscape element of the fair, he argued, had to have one supreme object, videlicet, the becomingness of everything that may be seen as a modestly contributive part of a grand whole, the major elements of which whole will be in the towering series of the main exhibition structures. In other words, the grounds, with all it carries, before, between, and behind the buildings, however dressed with turf or bedecked with flowers, shrubs, or trees, fountains, statues, bric-a-brac, and objects of art, should be one in unity of design with the buildings, should set off the buildings and should be set off in matters of light and shadow and tone by the buildings. Clearly certain sites were endowed more richly than others. More would be gained by associating the exposition with some feature of striking natural beauty than by the most elaborate and costly artificial decorations in the form of gardening features, terraces, fountains, and statues, than it is possible for the mind of man to devise or the hand of man to carry out. What the many factions in the battle for the fair seemed to ignore was that Chicago had but one natural object at all distinctively local, which can be regarded as an object of much grandeur, beauty, or interest. This is the lake. The lake was beautiful and always changing in hue and texture, but it was also, Olmsted argued, a novelty capable of amplifying the drawing power of the exposition. Many visitors from the heart of the country will, until they arrive here, never have seen a broad body of water extending to the horizon, will never have seen a vessel under sail, nor a steamboat of half the tonnage of those to be seen hourly passing in and out of Chicago Harbor, and will never have seen such effects of reflected light or of clouds piling up from the horizon as are to be enjoyed almost every summer's day on the lake margin of the city. Olmsted next considered four specific candidates: a site on the lakeshore above the loop, two inland sites, one of which was Garfield Park on the western perimeter of the city, and, of course, Jackson Park. Although Olmsted himself preferred the northernmost site, he insisted Jackson Park could work and produce results of a pleasingly becoming character, such as have not hitherto been aimed at in world's fairs. Olmsted dismissed the inland sites out of hand as being flat and monotonous and too far from the lake. In critiquing Garfield Park, he again took a moment to express his annoyance at Chicago's inability to select a site, a failure he found all the more exasperating given the elaborate boasts issued by the city's leading men back when they were lobbying Congress for the fair. But considering what has been so strenuously urged upon the attention of the country in regard to the number and excellence of sites which Chicago has to offer, considering what advantages the Centennial Fair in Philadelphia possessed in the neighboring scenery, considering what advantages of the same order would have been possessed by the fair if it had been given a site in the beautiful Rock Creek Valley at Washington, of which the nation is just taking possession for a park, considering what superb views were presented of the Palisades and up the valley of the Hudson on the one hand, and the waters and varied shores of Long Island Sound on the other, from the site offered for the fair by New York. Considering all this, we cannot but fear that the choice of a site in the rear of the city, utterly without natural landscape attraction, would be found a disappointment to the country, and that it would give occasion for not a little ironical reference to the claims of an endless extent of perfect sites made last winter before Congress. The emphasis was Olmsted's. Burnham hoped this second report would at last compel a decision. The delay was maddening, absurd, the hourglass long ago upended. The board seemed unaware that Chicago now risked becoming a national, even global, embarrassment. Weeks passed. By the end of October 1890, the site question remained unresolved. Burnham and Root tended to their fast-growing practice. Contractors had begun erecting two of the firm's newest, tallest Chicago skyscrapers, the Women's Christian Temperance Union Temple and the Masonic Fraternity Temple, at 21 stories, the tallest building in the world. The foundations of both were nearly finished and awaiting the installation of cornerstones. With architecture and construction such a fascination in Chicago, cornerstone ceremonies became extravagant affairs. The temperance celebration took place at the corner of LaSalle and Monroe, beside a 10-ton boulder of dark New Hampshire granite, 17 feet square by 3 feet thick. Here, Burnham and Root joined other dignitaries, including Mrs. Frances E. Willard, president of the union, and Carter Henry Harrison, a former mayor who, with four earlier terms already under his belt, was again running for the office. When Harrison appeared wearing his usual black slouch hat, his pocket quilled with cigars, the crowd roared a welcome, especially the Irish and Union men who saw Harrison as a friend of the city's lower classes. The presence of Burnham, Root, and Harrison beside the temperance stone was more than a bit ironic. As mayor, Harrison had kept a couple of cases of fine bourbon in his office at City Hall. The city's stern Protestant upper class saw him as a civic satyr whose tolerance of prostitution, gambling, and alcohol had allowed the city's vice districts, most notably the Levee, home of the infamous bartender and robber Mickey Finn, to swell to new heights of depravity. Root was a notorious bon vivant, whom Lewis Sullivan once described as a man of the world, of the flesh, and considerably of the devil. And Burnham, in addition to monitoring the global passage of his Madeira, each year bottled 400 quarts of lesser stuff sent to him by a friend, and personally selected the wines for the cellar of the Union League Club. With great ceremony, Burnham handed a silver-plated trowel to Mrs. T.B. Carse, president of the Temple Building Association, whose smile suggested she knew nothing of these monstrous habits, or at least was willing for the moment to ignore them. She scooped up a mound of mortar previously laid for purposes of the ceremony, then reapplied it and tapped it back into place. Prompting a witness to observe, she patted the mortar as a man sometimes pats the head of a curly-haired boy. She passed the trowel to the fearsome Mrs. Willard, who stopped the mortar more heartily and got some of it on her gown. Root, according to a witness, leaned toward friends and suggested sotto voce that they all cut away for cocktails. Nearby, at the distribution warehouse of the Chicago Inter-Ocean, a widely read and respected newspaper, a young Irish immigrant and staunch supporter of Carter Harrison completed his workday. His name was Patrick Eugene Joseph Prendergast. He ran a squad of obstreperous newsboys whom he loathed and who loathed him in return, as was clear by their taunts and practical jokes. That Prendergast might one day shape the destiny of the world's Columbian Exposition would have seemed ridiculous to these boys, for Prendergast, to them, was about as hapless and sorry a human being as they could imagine. He was 22 years old, born in Ireland in 1868. His family emigrated to the United States in 1871, and in August that year moved to Chicago, just in time to experience the Great Fire. He was always, as his mother said, a shy and retiring kind of a boy. He got his grade school education at Chicago's De La Salle Institute. Brother Adjutor, one of his teachers, said, "While in school he was a remarkable boy in this way, that he was very quiet and took no part in the play of the other students at noontime. He would generally stand around. From the appearance of the boy, I would be led to think that he was not well, that he was sick." Prendergast's father got him a job delivering telegrams for Western Union, which the boy held for a year and a half. When Prendergast was 13, his father died, and he lost his only friend. For a time, his withdrawal from the world seemed complete. He awakened slowly. He began reading books about law and politics and to attend meetings of the Single Tax Club, which embraced Henry George's belief that private landowners should pay a tax, essentially rent, to reflect the underlying truth that land belonged to everyone. At these meetings, Prendergast insisted on taking part in every conversation and once had to be carried from the room. To his mother, he seemed to be a different man, well-read, animated, involved. She said he got smart all of a sudden. In fact, his madness had become more profound. When he was not working, he wrote postcards, scores of them, perhaps hundreds, to the most powerful men in the city, in a voice that presumed he was their equal in social stature. He wrote to his beloved Harrison and to assorted other politicians, including the governor of Illinois. It's possible even Burnham received a card, given his new prominence. That Prendergast was a troubled young man was clear. That he might be dangerous seemed impossible. To anyone who met him, he appeared to be just another poor soul crushed by the din and filth of Chicago. But Prendergast had grand hopes for the future, all of which rested on one man, Carter Henry Harrison. He threw himself eagerly into Harrison's campaign, albeit without Harrison's knowledge, sending postcards by the dozens and telling anyone who would listen that Harrison, staunch friend of the Irish and the working man, was the best candidate for the job. He believed that when Harrison at last won his fifth two-year term, ideally in the upcoming April 1891 election, but perhaps not until the next in 1893, he would reward Prendergast with a job. That was how Chicago politics worked. He had no doubt that Harrison would come through and rescue him from the frozen mornings and venomous newsboys that for the moment defined his life. Among the most progressive alienists, this kind of unfounded belief was known as a delusion associated with a newly identified disorder called paranoia. Happily, most delusions were harmless. On October 25th, 1890, the site for the fair still unchosen, worrisome news arrived from Europe, the first hint of forces gathering that could do infinitely more damage to the fair than the director's stalemate. The Chicago Tribune reported that increasing turbulence in global markets had raised concerns in London that a recession, Even a full-blown panic could be in the offing. Immediately, these concerns began buffeting Wall Street. Railroad stocks tumbled. The value of Western Union's shares fell by 5%. The next Saturday, news of a truly stunning failure began stuttering through the submarine cable that linked Britain and America. In Chicago, before the news arrived, brokers spent a good deal of time discussing the morning's strange weather. An unusually murky pall hung over the city. Brokers joked how the gloom might be the signal that a day of judgment was at hand. The chuckling faded with the first telegrams from London. Baring Brothers and Company, the powerful London investment house, was on the verge of closure. The news, a Tribune writer observed, was almost incredible. The Bank of England and a syndicate of financiers were racing to raise a fund to guarantee Baring's financial obligations. The wild rush that followed to sell stocks was something terrible. It was a veritable panic for an hour. For Burnham and the exposition directors, this wave of financial damage was troubling. If indeed it marked the start of a true and deep financial panic, the timing was abysmal. In order for Chicago to live up to its boasts about surpassing the Paris Exposition in both size and attendance, the city would have to spend far more heavily than the French and capture a lot more visitors. Yet the Paris show had drawn more people than any other peaceful event in history. In the best of times, winning an audience of that scale would be a challenge. In the worst, impossible, especially since Chicago's interior location guaranteed that most visitors would have to buy an overnight train ticket. The railroads had made it known early and forcefully that they had no plans to discount their Chicago fares just for the exposition. Other corporate failures occurred both in Europe and the United States, but their true meaning remained for the moment unclear. In retrospect, a good thing.